Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now, When? In today's show, I am so excited to welcome my friend Ash Moya to join us today. Ash, she is a serious entrepreneur, turned advisor, and today author. And he is author of two best-selling books, Scaling Lean and Running Lean. He's also the creator of the most popular one-page business tool that we all love and used, Lean Canvas. Ash is also a leading business blogger, and his posts advise be featuring all the amazing publications such as Inc. Magazine, Forbes, Fortune. He regularly sold out workshops around the world and mentor for a lot of amazing accelerators such as Techstars, Captive Factories, and lecture at great universities such as Harvard, MIT, UT. He served on several advisory boards for startups as well as consult for new companies. Today, he is so passionate about giving back, serving, bring all his expertise back to the startup ecosystem, and I'm so excited to welcome him to join our show. Well, Ash, welcome and welcome. And finally, today's a date.
Yes, I'm excited to be here.
Amazing. So let's dive in, Ash. How does all that begin for you?
The journey, the entrepreneurial journey. So I guess I have
life journey, anything life journey. You like.
So, like a lot of entrepreneurs, there's something inside you. A few years ago, I pondered, are entrepreneurs made or born? And I think that it starts with the kindle of interest. So for me, I was always interested in creating something, a bit like an artist, bringing something new to the world. And that's in many ways what, even in a young age, I was always fascinated by, you know, the stories of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and, you know, people of that caliber and wondering, you know, what would it look like to be in that kind of a job, that kind of a role. So that was the original kindle for me.
And do you always knew that from that moment of kindling thought that is that kind of person is who you want to become?
I think it's a discovery process. Now I have kids and I ask them, you know, who do you want to be when you grow up? And like, I don't know. And and I would say that there's always a time, and I wouldn't say it was that crystal clear, but I was always a tinkerer. Mm-hmm. So when I would come back from school, had free time in my hands. And so I was always trying to run either little experiments. I'd read a book and want to build something or run some experiments. And then eventually wanted to show that, got into magic in the early years. So wanted to perform. For me, the prestige that you get with the magic trick of
you're being, actually a magician?
I'm not practiced by any means at this point. It's been many, many years, but that was a hobby of mine when I was younger. But wow. Like knowing, so, and I think entrepreneurship is a bit like that, is that you're launching a product and you want it to be amazing. And usually there's a secret, there's an insight that you have that you see the world the way others don't.
Mm.
And that excitement of I'm going to show something that others haven't seen. Like I've always had like that feeling mm-hmm. inside me.
Yeah. Wow, incredible. So you're always curious about the world. You start with magic when you were young, right? Tell us how that unfolding, how that lead to entrepreneurs.
So when I didn't grow up in the United States. When I came here,
where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Africa, Nigeria, West Africa.
Oh,
so my parents are Indian by origin, but they moved there for work, and so I was actually born and I grew up in Nigeria.
Oh,
till I was 16, and then I came here. So finished my schooling was a good student, but I always was most interested in wanting to start something of my own. And so when I left, I couldn't, for visa reasons and work permit reasons, couldn't start my own company. I would have jumped into it. And thankfully, that was something that I couldn't do and I didn't do. So I did the next best thing, which is joined a startup. And that's how I
kind of— When you were 16?
Well, no, when I graduated. So this was more when I was 21, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, 2021.
And what happened?
First product failed in the startup. So that's why I say, thankfully, that was a good good place to start so I could learn on other people's mistakes. So the first product failed. The second product was an okay success, but the third product actually took off.
Mm.
So it was good to see that arc. And at the same time, it was just a good learning process of how products are built, how people in the beginning don't really know what they're doing.
What is the biggest thing you learned in that experience?
So after that company exited, the founders went and started another company of their own because they thought, hey, we know now how to build products, and their next company didn't do all so well. And so
did not.
Oh. So those were like, I guess, triggers or sparks in my mind. So I'd observed that all these products started out as awesome, amazing things. They didn't go on to become awesome. And then when I left the company, I started my own startup. And similarly, the first product failed.
What's your first startup?
It was a company called Wired Reach.
Okay.
And it was built around this notion of 6 degrees of separation. So we're all connected by 6 people or less.
I love that.
And so it was the beginnings of what is now we call social networking. So this was like Facebook. Definitely like in, it was around the same time as Friendster. Like we were probably working at it around the same time.
Uh-huh.
And so I launched that product because it was a time where there was a recession. So there were a lot of people who had lost their jobs and I was trying to stay in touch with them. And again, this is like very early versions of the internet. So we're like, why don't we build like a social network? We weren't calling it that. So that was the idea of 6 degrees. The product was called 6 degrees. And so that was the original idea. And so that product did okay. It didn't quite work. We can talk about that if you wish. But after that, there were a few iterations and the same pattern emerged. The first product didn't work. Second product did okay. And then the third product did a lot better.
Why is that pattern specifically? Is there science behind that?
So that's what started, I guess, what got me interested to introspectively look into what separates good ideas from bad.
Mm, let's talk about it.
Right.
So, what do you think?
So good ideas are rare and hard to find. We all know that. But the problem that I think really bothered me was the cycle time. It was taking 18 months on average to tell if the idea was going to be good. And so when I started looking back, there were a few things that I realized is that one, you can test your idea a lot sooner. You don't have to build a product to test it. You can test it a lot sooner. And we weren't doing any of that. In all the companies that I worked in, we would come up with a plan. The founders or the executive team will say, let's go do this. And they'll put money. We just go and heads down, build something.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the build, demo, sell process. You build something, demo it, sell it. And if it doesn't sell, then you try to fix it. And that's just a very long process. And if you get it wrong, then too bad.
So what would your advice for founders who are listening, thinking, wow, that's what was happening in my mind. What do I do instead?
Right. So a very simple step is change the order. So build, demo, sell. If you instead demo, sell, build. So take the thing you're trying to build and just create a demo of it and go and show that to people. And if you can't sell the demo, why build the product? So kind of a very simple concept. You can see implementations of this, say, on crowdfunding. You go on Kickstarter, you see a pitch, you see a demo, you like it, you give them money. We can do this even in enterprise. So you can go to a company and you can pitch them an idea, you know, get the demo in front of them. If they see the value in it, they might say, let's start a pilot with you. So it works in all domains, but it's a very simple concept that took me many years to realize that you could start doing those things. And there are a few, I'm skipping some steps. There are a few steps before that. But that was the spark of what led to, you can say, the third act of my life. So the first act was all school learning.
Mm-hmm.
Second act was doing my own startup misadventures. And then in the third act, it was trying to make sense of the process of starting up.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to write about it first on the blog. Then it turned into books, turned into tools. And that's now what I do full time.
How incredible is that? I love that because you are, you know, so introspective. I feel like you have that curiosity still remain from, you mentioned when you're a child to adult and being an entrepreneur. And now using that curiosity to looking at all the experience, all the mistakes, and then hopefully someone else can, you know, learn from that.
Yeah. So I think before we started, we were talking about this notion of how we may look different, but we are all alike. And having grown up in Africa, of course, I saw that. And Nigerians are very entrepreneurial. You know, there's lots of business-minded folks there. So again, I saw some of those patterns there. But really, when I began researching for my book, I got called to do events and got to speak and got to travel to different parts of the world. And that was the thing I saw, is that we might look different, but we all fundamentally want the same thing. We fear the same things.
And which is what? What do you think we all want? And what do you think we all fear?
So I mean, we can get philosophical about this, but in the beginning, a lot of folks need their basic needs met. So, you know, if you look at whether you're a fan of the Maslow pyramid or not, like there's basic needs, and then we move up the chain, and then it's like social. In the entrepreneurial journey, I describe it as the artist phase, which is we all want to build awesome, amazing stuff. Where
you say artist, that's what I said too. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, continue.
So I think all entrepreneurs start as artists.
Yes, yes.
And at some point, we realize that artists can't just survive on art. They have to also be able to sell the art. So mm-hmm. we move from art to becoming more, you can say, money is a skill. So we learn about business, and we learn about how we sell, market, or we get other people to do it for us. And that's the second stage that entrepreneurs go through. And then the final stage, I call it the purpose stage. This is when we have achieved most of those basic needs, and now we want to give back, we want to make the world better, you know, all of those kind of things ensue from there. So I saw that fundamentally, when I would look at entrepreneurs, I would see them in the room, I would see them in one of those three stages. And then I would see the earlier ones doing all the same types of mistakes that I was doing early on. Mm-hmm. And that got me very excited. This kind of seems weird to say, but got me excited because we're more alike than unalike.
Yeah.
And so what I was writing about, I could go and share it and do what we were saying early on, try to avoid people from making at least those mistakes again. Mm-hmm. You know, they can make new mistakes because this stuff is always mm-hmm. changing. It's always complex to build something out of nothing. But at least not make the same mistakes that I took 5-7 years to figure out.
So. Yeah. Wow, there's so much to unpack. First of all, I personally a big fan of the hierarchy you just mentioned. I love that. And I love that you also have that distinct insight where in the room you can immediately tell who is in what stage, let's say 1, 2, and 3 stage you mentioned. I'm curious, within that 3 stage, what are the biggest mistakes within each of them that you can see and advising them accordingly?
Yeah. So I think in the starting stage, it is this...
Startup stage.
Yeah. So in the startup stage or the artist stage,
yeah,
it is this pursuit of product first or solution first. Like we want to go and paint an amazing canvas and mm-hmm. then show it to the world. The problem is that, at least in the entrepreneurial space, most first products miss the mark. Like what we think is amazing may not be amazing. And that's where we spend needless time, money, and effort finishing what we think is a masterpiece, only to realize it's not.
No one wanted.
Yeah. So that's the biggest mistake.
So how do we switch that?
Yeah. So if you can find a way to incrementally test the art, so instead of building, let's just say, if you were going to paint a mural, instead mm-hmm. of painting a 100-foot mural, start with some smaller things, right? So,
any concrete example or experiences you can share with founders who might be thinking, okay, I hear that, Ash, but how do I actually do that?
Yeah, so I always use this example because it's an easy one to start. And also, looking back, it seems obvious, but these things weren't so obvious. But if we think of starting a restaurant, a lot of people who want to start a restaurant, they might, you know, have the dream of what am I going to cook, come up with the menu, come up with the ambiance, find the best location. And then they get stuck because they don't have the money to afford the best location. And then if it fails, they'll say, oh, it's because I couldn't get the best location. So we kind of fall victim to some of those choices. But if we instead look at it differently, which is fundamentally starting a restaurant is about the food. So are there better ways to test food? You could start a catering. You could use a catering service. You could go to the farmer's market. You could find, if you were building a more high-end restaurant, find some friend chefs and host a one-night event with them and see, you know, does it actually engage with people? So those would be like faster ways of doing those kinds of experiments. And if that begins to work, then we double down and you start to build that traction, you start to build awareness, interest, and then you can take the next step. Food trucks, you know, food trucks used to be just for cheap street food. Today, we are seeing lots of high-end restaurateurs starting experimenting there, literally driving it around town, testing different mm-hmm. markets, opening brick and mortar locations based on the menu that works. So that's a simple example to get your head around, but that would be one example that I oftentimes start with.
Okay, so that's artist, sell first before you build. Now, the second stage, talk about the money is a skill. Talk about that phase.
Yeah, so sales and marketing. So I come from a technical background. I went to school for engineering. In my startups, I was the one writing the code.
Oh, and
so
I never I don't see that of you, Ash.
Yeah, so now I've again, different life. Like now I'm more I'm more writing, not code, but just writing online content, writing books, those types of things. But I was very much on the technical side. But one of the things I had to learn, because I at that time was bootstrapping, didn't really have a sales team, had to figure out that I'm creating this piece of art, but I've got to learn how to sell it. So marketing and sales was something I self-taught myself from books and then talking to other entrepreneur friends and figuring out how to do these types of things.
How do you say it?
It is a skill.
What is the number one pieces you felt like, wow, that's my biggest aha moment along those research and experiences?
So I think the biggest thing that makes people uncomfortable is talking about pricing. So we can talk a lot about it. We love to talk about our product, but the moment you get, when the customer says, so how much does it cost? There's this awkward conversation about pricing, and a lot of, at least the more introverted technical folks I talk to, like, hate sales for that reason. They don't want to really get into that kind of negotiating. And one of the things I've learned over time is that if you actually structure a pitch correctly, pricing doesn't have to be an emotional conversation.
So explain that, Ash.
Yeah. So if you set the stage, so typically when you are pitching a product, you have to create space for your product to enter. So we talk about like a big problem that the customer might be struggling with. And if they get them to nod their heads and agree with us, then we have opened a curiosity gap where they want to know how will we solve it. This is now where we show the demo. And the mistake that many people make is they try to show the full demo. They try to show everything about their product, but you want to only show the solution to the problem the customer just had. And at that point, they may be ready to buy. So at that point, if they need to see more, they'll ask for more, but otherwise we move into talking about pricing. And then if you've done your homework, you should have also understood in the conversation what they're currently doing today, where are they kind of getting stuck. And so when you get to price, you can really make a very rational case for how you priced your product. So if for example, you were selling enterprise software for, let's say, to an HR company, and you know in the conversation they were using a product, an existing product, and they were having certain issues, you can quantify the problems, you can talk about the pain that was in there, your demo now shows how that pain goes away, and you can say the value of this is this much. If the customer also acknowledges, then price just comes out from there, and say that's why we set our price at this level. So it becomes more a rational conversation where we anchor against their current state versus just trying to throw a number out of thin air and then, you know, with no justification, which is what I think a lot of people get stuck with.
I like that. Make it, you know, quantifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what's next? Then you close the deal, right? Hopefully.
Then usually at that point, it's like, how do we move forward? And depending on how complex the sale is, if the decision makers in the room, then it ends up being more a pilot or something that you can take as a next step. If they aren't in the room, then, you know, maybe the price conversation waits till they are in the room. But there are some nuances in how you do it, but those are basically the steps.
Really exciting.
Is make a promise, show how you deliver the promise, and then tell them the price.
What do you think is the number one skill set to differentiate people who not only know how to sell, but excel at selling? Because every entrepreneur has been through that transformation from artist to now entrepreneur, right? Besides having that container and that structure, is there fundamentally something different?
I think it's also getting one's mindset around what modern sales is about. Like one of the reasons why I think we all cringe when we hear sales is we are used to the image of the old, you know, the car salesman.
Buy one, get one free. 10% off today. Do it right now. Nice 30 minutes.
Right.
I got you.
Like that. Or you know, I've got to go talk to my manager, and then all the haggling and games that they play just to wear you out.
Yeah.
So we get, and we don't want to do those types of things. But I think that, especially with the internet, there is more, even when you go to car sales, if you buy a car today, you are walking in with a lot more information than your parents.
In the past, yeah.
So you, in the past, you didn't even know what the dealer paid for this. You didn't even know what the true value of the car was. So now you can come in with so much information. And so that's true across every product.
Mm-hmm.
So when customers come to the conversation, you can have a much more rational conversation with them on value. And that changes the whole sales dynamic.
Mm.
And ultimately, it's about at the end of the day, it's about creating value for your customers.
I love that. I love that. Because I believe it's never about the pricing. Like, what is $100? Is it too expensive? Too not expensive for what?
Yeah, compared to what?
If it's like a water bottle is $100, well, yeah, it's expensive. But if a round trip to Hawaii, all inclusive, entire week, the most beautiful resort you can ever imagine, $100, wow, it's a great deal.
Right.
So at the end of the day, it's never about the pricing, it's about the value. And I love that you articulate that so well.
Yeah. Even the $100 bottle, if it were in a gala where you were raising money for some cause.
Correct.
Then people, it would look crazy from the outside, but you could justify it.
It's all about the value rather than the thing, right? It's not about the feature, the product, it's about the value he or she are getting.
Correct. Absolutely.
So tell about the third phase, the purpose phase.
So the purpose phase, some people never get there. So this is, again, the artist phase. People who don't move off the artist phase will eventually probably either treat entrepreneurship as a hobby, so they'll always be a side project, or they'll eventually, you know, go back to a stable job. The people who are in the money phase, sometimes that phase lasts a long time. And so this is where you find serial entrepreneurs who are in it for the money. So they are looking for how do I reach that financial independence. And even when they reach it, some people look at, I know I have a few entrepreneur friends who haven't found that happiness with the money they have. And so they're going back to the game over and over again and just chasing
the benchmark.
Yet more money.
Keep moving.
Yeah. And so when I, you know, when they ask like, what does success look like for them, it's some amount of money, but they don't know what it is. And so you can get stuck in that phase.
Mm.
But I find that there's a subset of people who reach, and you don't have to be, you know, financial independence is all relative. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't need billions of dollars to be financially independent. The number is far less for most people. It's not one number for everyone, but it's far less. And I think that when people reach that point and when they have a calling for something bigger, then they shift into that purpose stage.
What is your stage?
I think it's with this company, it ended up being the excitement of, I mean, it's a combination of things. I think the entrepreneurship is a big problem to solve. And one of the things I noticed even 10 years ago is it's become a global problem. You're seeing entrepreneurs all over the world. And so I felt that both the market was big enough to go and do something meaningful here from a business perspective, but also more importantly, from giving back. You know, if we could create more successful entrepreneurs in the next 10 years, maybe we'd solve a lot of the world problems that we're seeing. Because ultimately, entrepreneurs are problem solvers. So for me, that was, I define what I do now. Sure, there's a business aspect to it, but it's driven more by the purpose of trying to figure out what does that early journey of an entrepreneur look like and how can we make it more systematic so more people enter this profession and be successful doing it.
I love that. So Ash, tell us really what you are doing today and how and where our entrepreneur can find you.
Sure. So today I run a company called LeanStack.
We all know that.
And we build we build tools for the early stage entrepreneur. So a lot of people may have heard of the concept of product market fit. This is when your product is working in the market. I am more interested in the journey to the left of product market fit. So I'm trying to make, so we sometimes call that the messy beginning, you know, start working on a bunch of things and most of it will not work. Sometimes magically something will work and then you scale it. But there is a process to it. So really what I have been looking at over the last 7 years or so is trying to curate there's never such a thing as a step-by-step process, but as close to a meta process for what one should focus on, like in the first 3 months of a product. Before it's built, like how you do those early tests, what you do when a product just launches, like I'm anti-public launch, like big bang launches, you know, you want to start small and incrementally roll out. So those are like all the things that we have curated over time with some tools, and that's what we build. So we build a set of playbooks as long with tools that go along with it, and you can find all that on leanstack.com.
Okay, good. So entrepreneur finds you directly through that, right? But you're also working with tell us more all the capacity so people can listen and say, wow, that's cool, Ash.
So I've been doing this maybe about 10 years. I'd been an entrepreneur before and then LeanStack, you can say, started 10 years ago. The first 5 years was about act one was about curating this process, which took a lot of experimenting. And then in the second act, it was more about teaching what we had. So I began sharing this in workshops, and we ran boot camps, and we brought lots of startups. Like by now, I think we've worked with like 10,000 startups or over the years. And then Act Three, which started about 3 years ago, was packaging all we do and then teaching others. So train the trainer type of a model. So now we work with universities, we work with accelerators like Mass Challenge, we work with corporate innovators, we work with consultants and coaches who are running their own agencies or virtual studios. And so we are teaching them kind of what we have learned of taming the early stages, and giving them the platform and the tools to do that. So that's another kind of aspect of the business.
How amazing. I love that. I love that in all the stages, I felt like the purpose is all throughout, and you are truly have such a big heart to, you know, giving back and serving the entrepreneur ecosystem, which is just so incredible.
Thank you. But yeah, but I go back to like the, our measure of success is number of successful entrepreneurs created. Mm. So, you know, speaking of making dents, we want to look back 10, 20 years from now and say, when we started, what were those numbers? And when we're done, hopefully the numbers are better.
But at this moment, I'm curious, how do you think about success at this very moment? And how do you define success? And with that, do you think you are successful?
How do I define success? I think it's, I mean, so there are different ways to answer that. So on a personal level, like does one enjoy the work? I look at this as probably going to be my life's work. Like as I mentioned, I've started many different companies, and many of them were opportunistic. You know, here's a technology, or here's an idea, or here's a problem that would be good to solve. But they didn't really stick because they were more opportunistic. This is one where I feel like the problem of making sense of entrepreneurship is probably never, it's not going to end in my lifetime. And so it can be lifetime work. And I enjoy it so much that I can do it. So from that perspective, that to me is like one check on the success, like, you know, do something you love. Like, I love doing this. It never gets tiring. So if I go and even I've delivered probably the same talk hundreds of times with a different audience, but each time it's interesting and exciting.
Yeah.
Even though I know the questions that are going to be asked, sometimes tell the same jokes and have the same answers, but it's still interesting and exciting.
Yeah.
To be able to see people, the way they react to those things. So that's one level. And then there's, of course, the business model level. So I'd like to, obviously create a successful company so that we can have the biggest impact. But the biggest driver is really how many entrepreneurs we serve at the end of the day. And that's why, on the one hand, we could have kept a lot of this proprietary and try to build an accelerator, or try to build the world's biggest, you know, venture fund or something like that. But that was not interesting because that's closed and proprietary. So we decided very early on that we were going to open this up and teach anyone who wants to learn it so that we can impact more people.
Wow. So are you a success in that measure?
It's a story that's unfolding, but I would say that, you know, from the numbers, we are bringing on bigger and bigger clients. We are working with, so we easily have hundreds of universities using our tools, but we are more formally bringing like universities, because that's the future of entrepreneurship. So we are investing very heavily in getting these kinds of mindsets so that even when before they even make those mistakes, they don't even go down that path. That would be pretty interesting to see. So from that perspective, I would say yes. I mean, I'm pretty happy with where we are, and we still have a long way ahead.
Of course, until the last breath, or right?
Right.
I love that, Ash. And I love what you speak about, you know, you truly today are giving back and meeting those amazing entrepreneurs where they are. And I'm curious, you know, now circle back to the entrepreneurship journey. You mentioned about a lot of questions are asking to you, right? Maybe over and over again, right? What are the most asked questions in those three different stages we just defined earlier?
Well, so I would say in the first stage with most of the audiences, it's a lot of the how-to. So, you know, it's easy to hear things like you should talk to customers, or you should test, like just what we did here. And the question is how, like, you know.
Yeah.
And also when I share an example like the food truck one, people would say, oh yeah, but food is easy because I can cook it in 2 hours. But if I'm building something that's going to take me 6 months, how do I test? So it comes down to there are principles and then there are tactics.
So tell us about the tactic for some of our listeners probably at this moment, like so leaning in this, you know, their phone, like, wow, this is so cool. And I'm with the food truck, but I'm not selling food right now. So what do I actually do?
So I'll go from an extreme case study, and which is actually what I do when I share the food truck example, because people get it, and I've learned that people will say that's too simple. So now I go to Tesla, and I go into a story about how they built their first car, right? So if you think of building an electric car, it's a pretty complicated thing. You can't just cook for 2 hours. It takes 10 years for a company to build a car. And so Tesla went down the same thought process of how do we test the concept? And so first it was about the value proposition. So why electric? Like, what does electric really buy you? So you could see Elon Musk in 2006 talking about the zero emissions future, you know, sustainability, and he got a lot of people excited, and people were already buying hybrids. So you get an audience and they're now interested, but you still have to build a car. So how do you do that? It's not going to take you 2 hours, but for them, it took them 2 years. But 2 years is still five times faster than an average car company. Mm-hmm. And that's because they took a huge shortcut. So they realized that if they are building an electric car, the thing that is different is that it's electric, but the car doesn't have to be different. They don't have to invent a new car. So what they did is they licensed somebody else's car, put a battery in it, and sold it as their own, right? So this was the Lotus Roadster that they had. And if you think of the demo of that concept, like even before they did that, they took pre-orders 2 years prior. And the way they could do that is they just took Photoshop or whatever their favorite photo editing software was, got a Lotus, put their logo on it. So got a red Lotus, put a logo on it, and then they could pitch this. So Elon Musk could come to you and say, we're building an electric car. We're going to license a Lotus and put a battery in it, which we're working on in the lab, and it's going to be electric. It's going to cost $150,000. Do you want it? And people give him their money. And so that's how you can test the idea.
For entrepreneurs who are maybe building something in the enterprise space where, you know, getting the conversation started is already hard enough, how do you advise that process to her or him?
So if you think of sales, so once your product is built, you're still going to have to talk to those
people. Right, it's the same thing.
The same challenge. So that's what I first tell them, is that you have to solve that, that talking
fair point
to people question. And that's the whole thing, is that in the beginning, the company doesn't even want to see your product. They want to know, what does the product do? Like, what is it about? And that's how you might lead out, you know, you might reach out to them. And so that's part of the process we teach, is a problem discovery, then pitching process. So it's a bit like, just in complex sales, you start with discovery, which is qualification and all of those bits. And then you go into understanding. So that's where you understand the customer's needs. And then you pitch them a product. The only difference is that later on, you will have the product built. In this stage, you don't, right? But you're still having to do the same exact things, which is understand, what is your product for? Like, what job will it do? What are people currently using? And then you might send out either hopefully a warm referral, because that's an easier one to get than just go out cold, and then have some friendly conversations on how people are solving the problem today. What will you build? And then you start showing concepts or pitching them. And mm-hmm. if they say this is interesting, then you go build it. So it's in much the same. It's like you said, it's the same steps you have to do mm-hmm. later on. We're just bringing the sales steps or the demoing steps far earlier in the process.
Again, sell first, build second.
Yeah, sell before you build.
I love that, Ash. And I'm just curious, you know, circle back to your journey has been, what, 2-3 decades of you, you know, dedicating in a startup space, and now, you know, from the building, creating, now teaching and inspiring and advising. And I'm curious, Ash, you know, for you, what do you think is your superpower?
I think for me, it's thinking and writing. So I think you made a comment that you think I'm a thinker, but I think that is, that's right. So I love to think in models. Like, I love to look for, so that was another thing, maybe as a child, along with the magic, I was very interested in connections between things. I think things are inherently connected. You can take concepts from science and apply them in business and vice versa. So I'm always looking for those kind of patterns. So I think a lot, and then the way to express the thinking I accidentally stumbled into was writing, and writing helped me think better. So that's why I first wrote, and then it helped other people understand better. And so that's why I still write. So I would say that it's the thinking and writing that that I think I contribute with the most.
Incredible. I think it's your ability to bring that critical thinking to everything you observe around you, and then create that insight that hopefully everyone else can all have that takeaway.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just about thinking or just the writing. There's much more than
that. I guess you would describe that as the synthesis step.
So
synthesizing the concepts together and mm-hmm. and then trying to present it in a way that's understandable. Yes.
Brilliant. And, you know, since you're coming to the United States, what, 16? I'm curious if I can, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs in a podcast listening, they know about my journey, about my American dream, and therefore when I apply, I always love to ask, like, hey, Ash, you come this far, right? You have created an incredible success, not only for yourself, but also for many, many entrepreneurs, you know, across the globe. I'm curious, how do you think about American dream?
I think it's at this point, it's a global dream. So it's, yeah. I truly, truly do believe that. So the original American dream, of course, was to come to the land of opportunity. Yeah. You had, you know, equal opportunity, all of those kinds of values and aspirations where you can come here and do it. And I don't think it's near equal. Even here today, like, there's not, the American dream is not as strong as, or as maybe powerful as it used to be before. But I think ultimately, like, the mission here is trying to think of it more as a, on a global platform. When I go back to people wanting the same things, we all want a better life. We all want a better place. And so if we can encourage more people to become entrepreneurs and not just think about coming to the US, to Silicon Valley or wherever else, but staying where they are and building those ecosystems, that to me is also what really got me very excited is, so preventing the brain drain from different countries, but letting people build their own version of the American dream just wherever they are.
I love that everybody had the possibility to shine their light at wherever they are. And I think, like you said, we are all in the exact same journey to pursue that happiness, love, peace, whatever you call it, by sharing our gift. Whether you are entrepreneur selling flowers, you are entrepreneur selling sex models, you are like selling all the amazing things. I think we are all here just doing what we loved and what we do the best and be part of a community.
Yeah, exactly.
If one day we all long pass, I'm curious, we all going to die, Ash, on your gravestone, what do you want it said? If it will be like one sentence or like five words or less, what do you want it said?
Well, I don't know that I've actually thought that hard about what the words would be, but it would be something along the lines of the work mattered. So I do look at, you know, this as a life's work, and as I said, it's never going to end. But if it can reach a point where it helps push something forward, and someone could say that that is something we remember, that would be enough.
Make an impact. Incredible. Any other thought, any other part we thought you want to share with entrepreneurs who are maybe right now hearing your story, feeling so inspired, feel like, wow, this is possible for me, but maybe he or she in the early stage of journey and feeling a little bit struggle, maybe a little bit discouraged, especially in today's, you know, funding environment or the product environment, you know, anything that you want to share with her or him?
Yeah. So I would say that I bootstrapped my company, and even to date, I've not raised a single dollar externally.
Wow.
And that, you know, takes, you can say, you know, great perseverance, all those things. But at the end, I read this in a book, The Stockdale Paradox, Jim Collins' book, Good to Great. But he talks about the Stockdale Paradox, and people can look at it.
Tell about the paradox.
But it's I'll kind of just maybe lead to the punchline, which is this whole idea that, you know, one needs to confront, the paradox is you have to confront your brutal reality, which always feels far worse than, you know, it's far worse than we think, but you have to confront your reality. But at the end, we have to have this belief that we are going to persevere, right?
Wait, so our reality is worse than what we think?
It can be for certain people. And this is like, if I bring this in the startup world, nothing may have changed in the startup, but one day we feel like we're on top of the world because everything's great. And the other day we're curled like a ball, but nothing has really changed, but it's kind of perception. And so the first challenge is, how do we really confront the reality, like the real truth about where we are? And then from there, there's also this belief that one needs to have is that as entrepreneurs, we're going to persevere. Like the ideas, and this is one of the things we try to teach with the teams we work with, is that most ideas that we work with in the early stages, we almost convince we don't force them, the founders themselves kill those ideas off because they're flawed in some way. And so what I tell them is that my long-term commitment is to make you successful as an entrepreneur, not your idea. I don't care about your idea. And I think that is this detachment that is hard to do, because many times entrepreneurs identify themselves with their ideas. And when the idea is failing, they feel like they're failing.
Oh, that's so good. again, we are not our company. We are not our balance sheet. We are not whatever money we are raising or not raising. We are not whatever IPO date or the price, all and above. And I think that's so brilliant said, because, you know, there are so much up and downs. And how do you remain so zen, Ash, in that process? Because you live there, you've been there. You also active advising amazing men and women in the game, right? And how do you not let it bother you?
Yeah, so I think it's a philosophy of right action, right time. So there's actually a friend, Bijoy, that I have, who's actually in Austin as well. Many years ago, he shared this idea concept with me of there are, in a startup especially, there are hundreds of things we can go work on, but there's usually a single domino or a single area that is the weakest link. Mm-hmm. And if we can instead just get, if we can identify it, that already is, removes a lot of stress, because it means we don't have to worry about the hundred things, there's only one thing. So that is already progress. And then once we start looking at that one thing, we can come up with many ways to address it. So for me, that has become almost like a daily habit. Like I wake up every day and I'm always looking for what is that single boulder or domino or constraint that I have to work on today. And I try to do that early in the day. So I tend to be more accomplishment driven. If I get stuck in email or meetings in the morning, then my day feels very draining. But if I can move that boulder even an inch mm-hmm. in the morning when I'm undistracted, then I feel, like you said, a lot more in a zen state or a lot more accomplished. And then the day can have its downs, but I feel like I've already moved something important that day.
What a great perspective. One thing per day, and just one.
Yeah.
Not 100, but one. What is one thing that will move the needle that may you feel proud before you go to bed tonight? I love that perspective, because I think in entrepreneurship world, people are wearing 1,000 hats. They're like, okay, I got so many things to do. I do this and this and this. And we become reactive to whatever the environment come to us. And we felt discouraged when people say no. When we view discouraged when that did not work out, and so on and so forth. Therefore, we lose the track about how we truly show up, how we really serve, how we truly solving a problem for our customers and focusing on truth to our why.
Exactly.
Amazing, Ash. Truly, you know, thank you so much for coming online and share such a transparent and authentic stories. And I'm just so inspired by how self-aware you are. I think along the journey, whether it's you mentioned how you grew up or your startup journey or today you're giving back, I think every step along the journey, you're always very aware about who you are, where you are, and how you can better serve, how you can add in value, solving the problem for the customer or now solving the problem for the global entrepreneurship ecosystem. And today, you know, you're such a, you know, big heart about giving back, and whether it's a workshop, today's podcast, or the book that you're launching, all and above, just truly such inspiration. So thank you, Ash, for being here today. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Wen. Appreciate your work too. Amazing. Thank you.
What an honor. And thank you for everybody who listening today. We hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. And we cannot wait to see you all next time. Bye, guys.